Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that does for comic book movies what the Addams Family did for pinball. I'm Seb Patrick, and joining me to be creepy, kooky, mysterious, spooky, and altogether ooky is...
James Hunt. Just James Hunt. No one else.
Yes, we are on a two-hander for this podcast, inability to line up our guests for this one. We're kind of doing this as a Halloween special, but where most specials of things are like longer and bigger, this one's kind of the opposite.
As a special treat, we're giving you less of us.
Yes. Couple of reasons for this. Partly to make sure that we actually do get it out in time for Halloween, because there's no point doing a Halloween special on the 1st or 2nd of November. So to give us enough time to actually get around to recording this with our schedules and illness and various other things, and also to edit it. This is going to be shorter than usual, and how we're going to do that is we are going to skip the news. There actually hasn't really been a load of stuff recently. There's maybe one or two things to talk about, but we did do a big News Minnesota catch-up earlier in the month, and we'll do another one early in November, so we'll cover anything that may or may not happen. But what will probably happen is between recording this and it coming out, as always happens, something absolutely major will happen, so you can look forward to that. We've caused that to happen. But in the meantime, we're here to talk about... So this is kind of officially our episode on the 1991, Barry Sonnenfeld's 1991 film, The Addams Family. We are also going to talk about the 1993 sequel, Addams Family Values, just because we probably won't otherwise get an opportunity. I doubt we'd end up doing this twice. So we're going to cover both of those films. We were looking at potentially covering the new one that's just come out to make it nice and topical in a new release episode, but neither of us have seen it. James was possibly going to, but James, what happened?
I was supposed to, but my daughter changed her mind about wanting to go and see it and asked if we could stay in and play Nintendo. So
hard to argue.
It's hard to turn that down, to be honest.
Yeah. There is also a third Addams Family film that some people may not be aware of that I intend to briefly talk about when we've covered the first two as well. Because, we could talk about whether it's technically part of the same series or not. But it's about the only interesting thing about it. In the meantime, before any of that, and before we don't do news, I'm going to ask James to explain to me something about comics. And a little while ago, you may recall on our Matrix episode, we recorded that just after the first issue of Jonathan Hickman's X-Men run, which began with the twin interlinked miniseries House of X and Powers of X. The first issue of House of X had just come out, so we were able to make all kinds of speculation and judgments based on a single issue of what will probably be a several years long form run. We've now had 13 issues of that run, and the first issue of something written by somebody else. Is Marauders by somebody else?
Marauders is by someone else, yeah.
So we've had the 12 issues of House of X and Powers of X combined, and we've had the first issue of the actual X-Men ongoing series by Hickman. So now that we've got this far in, James, do you have any more snap judgments or predictions? What's been going on? What was the premise of the two miniseries? What did that end up being? For anyone who's not been following, what's been happening, and is it interesting and is it good?
Yeah, so it is both extremely interesting and very good. The concept seems to be that, armed with knowledge of the future, the I guess mainly Xavier, but the X-Men in general have sort of clubbed together to form a sort of futuristic society on the island of Krakoa. And rather than trying to protect a world that hates and fears them, they are sort of, they've gone into this kind of imperial thing of they've created a country and they're no longer hiding. They've invited all mutants to de facto join their nation as members of the mutant like society. They have also, they're so technologically advanced, they've conquered death. So every time an X-Men dies or any mutant dies, they can restore their mind from a backup and grow them in a clone. I mean, it's really sprawling. It's kind of hard to explain in a really simple way, but it's kind of coherent and interesting in a way that X-Men hasn't been probably since Grant Morrison took over. So I'm really excited by what's actually happening in it. And I know you've read everything as well, have you?
Yes, I've read everything except for that first issue of Marauders, the first of the kind of non-Hickman but related X series that have launched. But no, I did end up, after not being sure if I was going to, I did end up reading all of House and Powers of X, and I picked up the first issue of X-Men proper. I did find at times, particularly with Powers of X, when it's kind of jumping into the future that you know, and what I kind of got the impression of was that the reason for showing us that future, you know, all that future stuff was in order to show us the future that would come to pass if the X-Men don't do what they're doing now, effectively, because there is a character.
Yeah, well, it's one of the futures.
Yeah. But I found, other than occasionally not always following exactly what was going on, particularly in the future with concepts that sometimes with things like this, I don't know if these are things that I'm supposed to know from like a background in the characters or if they're stuff I'm not supposed to know because they're new and they're supposed to be, you know, obfuscated and confusing.
Yeah, just quickly on that point, I think a lot of people when they read comics, especially X-Men comics, get sort of hung up on the idea of like, ooh, am I supposed to know this? Like, what's going on? In any case, the answer, especially in Hickman's case, is that if you need to know, you'll be told, and if you don't, it might just be an Easter egg. Like, don't get too hung up on whether you're supposed to recognise any of this stuff or not.
Yeah.
Because all the information you get is in the story when you need it.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, a lot of that future stuff was just completely new, and like, I was as in the dark as anyone.
Yeah. I think I got, as it went on, I got that impression that, yeah, these were actually a lot of things that he was introducing fresh. But aside from that, aside from the kind of the big sprawling idea stuff, the main thing that struck me was how fun a lot of it's been so far. And I didn't really expect that. I think because I often haven't felt a kind of sense of fun and even warmth in, like, I do find Hickman's work quite dry and cold a lot of the time. But he is obviously having so much fun writing the voices of characters like Xavier and Magneto and Emma Frost. Like, he is really well suited, especially to writing Magneto.
I was about to say, his Magneto is amazing. Yeah. Like, he's such a great version of that character.
And there's like one scene with Namor in it, and you know, Namor having a conversation with Xavier and Magneto about it. And again, just like, you know, the way that he writes those kind of characters, he's very good at writing those characters who believe that they are better than everybody else, which is pretty much the thrust of what the great line from Namor is. So I've really liked that. And I always like X-Men stories where Magneto is on the same side as Xavier, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, I mean, in this case, he is being kind of very friendly, but it's like, I like that you've always got that undercurrent with Magneto of, well, if he decides that he's going to go off on his own ideas, then he will, you know.
The thing I like about this version of Magneto is that he's like walking around with sort of grandiose fantasies of being like a living god, and this time it's as if the X-Men have bought into his like,
yeah,
actual,
yeah,
like Xavier narrative.
He's almost the Xavier here, because he is the one who's kind of, because Xavier's hiding, but well, hiding in one sense, we don't really know what's going on with the Cerebro helmet, the way that means we're not seeing Xavier's face at any point. But Xavier is kind of more the cold and distant one, and Magneto is the one who's getting really emotional and enthusiastic about what's going on. And kind of inspiring people more, I think, you know, being the kind of
like
the
when he's
figurehead.
walking amongst the mutant kids who are like flocking to him like he's one of the Beatles or something.
So that's been really fun. I think he's writing Cyclops well as well. I think it's really interesting that sort of we've had kind of so long now of Cyclops kind of being in the role that he's in, of sort of. And like what I feel like we've been seeing for quite a while in X-Men comics now is Cyclops now represents the effect of being someone who grew up kind of with Xavier's ideals and how that's kind of shaped and changed him, rather than him just being, you know, the kind of steadfast leader guy. It's like, well, what happens when all that stuff is going round and round in your head, and then all the things that happen to you to him happen to you? What comes out the other side? Like, what? Okay, this is going to sound like a slightly weird comparison, but Cyclops to me now feels like what they did with Dick Grayson in the 80s when they had him lead the Teen Titans and then they had him become Nightwing. It's like he's the what comes next stage of being the kind of the faithful sidekick character. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I like that. I think, and you know, the whole plot thing with Moira and sort of her. You know, what it turns out that her big deal is, you know, was it, I mean, I'm going to say it was inspired, even though it immediately got accused of ripping off several other stories, but it didn't matter because
it was inspired by an existing sci-fi novel.
But yeah, no, I've found that as someone who's, you know, not as long-term invested in the X-Men as you, but likes reading a good X-Men comic when I find one, that it's interesting ideas and it's good character stuff. And it sounds like from your perspective, as someone who's massively invested in it.
I mean, I'm like, my barometer for a good X-Men comic is like 80s Claremont, noughties Morrison, and this is definitely up there with them. Like, I have a soft spot for the sort of 90s, like soap opera craziness, but this is objectively brilliant. So I'm very happy because I will read even bad X-Men comics, and these are far from being bad X-Men comics.
And just so that we can kind of look back on this in future and judge, do you have any feelings about things it might do or direction it might go?
I'm pretty sure that whoever is running the show, it's not Charles Xavier.
As in, you think there's someone behind him, or you think that dude in the helmet is not Charles Xavier?
Yes. I think I'm not 100% sure. I wouldn't be unsurprised to find out that it was Cassandra Nova under the helmet.
I was just going
to
say, do you think it's Cassandra Nova?
Yeah, that's a strong possibility.
We'll see. I look forward, as I say, in about 6 months' time when it turns out not to be the case. we can talk about it then.
Yep.
Okay, so a little bit earlier than usual, but let's move on to some movie discussion. As I say, we're going to kick off by talking about the first film, and then I think we'll probably at some point when we've exhausted that naturally segue into the second one. So before we get going, let's listen to a trailer, probably, for Barry Sonnenfeld's 1991 film, The Addams Family, which you may not even have known was based on a comic.
When we first met years ago, it was an evening much like this. Magic in the air. A boy.
A girl.
An open grave.
You were so beautiful. Pale and mysterious. No one even looked at the corpse.
Ah! Miss!
Wednesday, play with your food.
Is this made from real lemons?
Yes.
I'll buy a cup. If you buy a box of my delicious Girl Scout cookies.
Are they made from real Girl Scouts?
Dang, you're a handful. I've done this before.
This holiday season, they'll make you feel right at home.
Last night, you were like some desperate howling demon. You frightened me. Do it again.
The Addams Family. Sorry. But you'll have to wait until November 22nd.
Okay, so that was the trailer for the first Addams Family film. Well, I mean, the first in this series of Addams Family films, but I think not the first Addams Family film generally, because I think there had been a TV movie of the TV series back in the 70s. So the Addams Family's got an interesting history. As I say, I think it's one that wouldn't necessarily occur to people as a comic book movie. And actually, comic book is a misnomer here.
I was going to say,
it's based on comics, cartoons.
There are no comic books that qualify as source material, put it that way.
Yeah. But the Addams Family originated in the 1930s as a series of New York cartoons by Charles Addams. He named them after himself. They were single panel gag cartoons, weren't they? I think, you know, there's not even any kind of narrative to them. Other than the fact that obviously the characteristics of the family would get established as they went on, so there would be kind of running characteristics. But as far as I'm aware, there's never any kind of, you know, strip to strip narrative between them. They're very much, you know, kind of isolated gag comics. But I think when they kind of really passed into the mass cultural consciousness was in the 1960s with that TV series, which debuted in 1964. Famously starred John Astin, who I still can't get over how weird it is seeing him as the Riddler in the second season of the 66 Batman series, because there was a financial dispute with Frank Gorshin, so they cast John Astin, who looks and sounds nothing like Frank Gorshin, to play the Riddler, and then Frank Gorshin comes back for season three. But while he wasn't the best Riddler, I think he was the sort of the standout feature, well, one of the standout features of the 60s TV series, because the other standout feature was the theme tune that it gave to the world. The
60s really smashed it with theme tunes, didn't it?
Really did, yeah. Yes.
What happened?
Yeah, it's one of those where, yeah, like a lot of shows, if they had a memorable theme tune in the 60s, they would keep that theme tune in kind of later reimagining.
Well, even the, like, I always think it's funny how the, like, a Spider-Man film released in 2019
yeah.
has the 60s Spider-Man theme in it.
Yeah.
Because it's just so synonymous with the character.
And you know, Batman, obviously, you know, for all the Batman themes that there have been, that is the one that people will most remember. And absolutely, you can't do Addams Family without doing the da-da-da-da, click. It's just, you know. The other weird thing about the Addams Family is that it's sort of, and I meant to kind of check the dates here as to the contemporaneousness of them, but there you go. No, it was literally the same year. It was also 1964 that the Munsters launched.
Is this a Man-Thing, Swamp-Thing situation?
I think it must be. I've not kind of looked into and read up on, you know, kind of which came first or you know, which was seen. So I mean, they are different. You know, I mean, what they both are is shows about unconventional, macabre families. But you know, the Addams Family aren't monsters. They're weird people who like monstery things, whereas the Munsters are, you know, there's a vampire and there's a Frankenstein, and I think it's acceptable to say a Frankenstein, but I won't get into that debate now. So there is a difference, but equally it is kind of weird that they both showed up at the same time. But while the Munsters, like the Addams Family, had later TV reimaginings, what the Munsters never had was a successful 1990s movie. But it wasn't, it initially didn't seem like it was going to be a success, to the extent, like, it was a real struggle making it, apparently. There were kind of issues during the shooting. I think it's Barry Sonnenfeld's first film. He was obviously famously the cinematographer for the Coen brothers, among other people. But then this was kind of his directorial debut. But it was a bit of a struggle to get made. And then the original studio, Orion, actually pretty much ditched it. They sold it to Paramount. So this was a film that had a $25 million budget and ended up having $30 million spent on it. Orion thought it was going to be a massive flop, so they sold it to Paramount to distribute. And Paramount walked away with a $191 million box office.
I was going to say, that is, as decisions go, that was a poor one.
Yeah,
well, that is giving away your winning lottery ticket.
Yeah. What's even better is that that then led them to spend a load more money on the sequel, and the sequel only just broke even.
That's insane to me. Absolutely insane. Yes, well, having watched them back to back, and we'll get to that, but wow.
We will get to that. It is. But then again, you know, maybe the box office for a second film is contingent on what the first film is like. But the point is, the first film was a massive hit. I can't believe the drop-off for Addams Family Values, because it's a phenomenal film. But we're going to get to it. We've got to talk about the first film first. Yeah, so Addams Family comes out in 1991. It's one of those where, I mean, this is the kind of the early 90s, the sort of, I think, kicking off us, or even probably continuing a kind of golden era for sort of high concept comedies. And it just absolutely taps into something that means it becomes this massive runaway hit. You can't escape MC Hammer's Addams Groove over the winter of 1991.
The world of pinball is transformed.
The world of pinball is transformed. I do want to talk about the pinball table, so I'm not going to throw it away on a little bit at the start. I'm actually going to talk about the pinball table, because I think it's the biggest, most enduring legacy of this entire film series, because it's the best pinball table ever made. But yeah, it really did sort of, I mean, the 60s TV series was one of those things, as I say, that was kind of in the cultural consciousness. But I think that, you know, the movie went a long way to really kind of re-establishing Addams Family as a brand, to the extent that ever since then, obviously with breaks, it has been a franchise that people have revived and done things with pretty much ever since. You've had the films, you had the attempt to mount a new TV show off the back of the films, you had a cartoon off the back of the films, you had video games, then more recently there's been a musical, and then there's a new animated movie out this year. So, you know, as I say, when you look at the kind of the two of them, the Addams Family and the Munsters, the Addams Family was the one that was able to pick up that momentum, and it's all off the back of this movie being a massive hit. What did you think about it going back to it now, though? And that's a bit of a leading question, but because we have discussed this a bit already.
Yeah, so it's funny, because my memory of the second film was a lot stronger. I think I probably saw the second one in the cinema and not this one. I've not revisited either, probably for going, like, probably 15, 20 years since I last watched them. That first one, surprisingly weak. Like, the thing that strikes me about it is the cast is all amazing. Like, absolutely perfect cast.
Yeah.
Story, not so great. A few good jokes, but also, like, in terms of the structure, it's really sort of stop-start. The first half of the film, basically, just seems to be a bunch of small set pieces.
Yeah.
That don't really go anywhere. And then you get this sort of really incredibly weak actual plot about, like, oh, this guy is pretending to be Fester. And you're like, yeah, but come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
I like the idea of the plot of, you know, Fester having been estranged from the family / missing, and then somebody shows up in their lives and you don't know if it's Fester. As an idea, I think that's pretty good, because what that gives you is, that gives you your way in. That gives you your way to introduce the family by showing them from an outsider's perspective. So I can see why that makes sense. I think the biggest issue with it is, though, that you never don't believe that this is Fester. Not least because the film is marketed on the idea that Christopher Lloyd is playing Fester, and he's in the posters as Fester with the shaved head and everything. And it's like, you know, the idea that this guy with hair, who's Christopher Lloyd and who looks and sounds like Uncle Fester, isn't Uncle Fester, you're never going to buy that. So just from a kind of plot buy-in point of view, it doesn't really convince.
As soon as he turns up, like, the first thing he does is, like, grab the lawyer guy, you know, hold him against a wall inverted while grunting like a maniac. It's like,
yeah,
if you were going to try and convince us that this guy is someone else, make it a bit more subtle. Like,
but I think also it's kind of indicative of the fact that, as I say, what the film kind of feels obliged to do is to sort of introduce us to the Addams Family. And I think this is where it gets everything kind of back to front, because I think the film itself shows later, and then its own sequel absolutely 100% shows, that the way to make the Addams Family funny is not to have kind of not to show the perspective of ordinary people and go, look at this weird family. It's to do it from the perspective of the Adamses and put the Adams among supposedly normal people who are actually crazier and weirder than them. Because that's the key thing. And I mean, to be honest, I don't know how much it holds true of the 60s TV series because I don't know it that well. But what I think really characterises these two films, and it's the kind of, it's the great irony, is that the Addams Family are supposedly weirdos, but as a family, they are, I mean, okay, aside from the fact that Wednesday's constantly trying to murder Pugsley, aside from that, it's kind of like the argument with The Simpsons. It's like, as a family, they're actually great because they, you know, Morticia and Gomez are obsessed with each other. The family look out for each other. And it's like, you know, they are a functioning, they're not a dysfunctional family. They're a functioning family unit.
Yeah, they're completely functional.
Yeah, it's just they're kind of all their peccadilloes, you know, and they're sort of, you know, their weirdness in inverted commas isn't actually anything that's intrinsic to what they're like as people. And so what's great is when you get a little bit of it in this film, and as I say, you get it much more in Adam's Family Values, is, well, here's what happens when you take these people and put them in the real world. And then I think what Adam's Family Values really lays on is actually the white, blonde, suburbanite, rich people are far creepier than the Adamses, who actually have a strong moral core, you know?
Yeah.
But here, you've got that sequence kind of late on, and it comes far too late in the film, it really does, where they've been booted out of the house because Festa/Gordon is the rightful inheritor of it, and they have to go and live in a motel. And Gomez is sat there watching Sally, Jesse, Raphael and phoning them up every 5 minutes. And that's, I think, most of the best jokes in the film come in about a 15-minute segment that comes far too late and is over too quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the weird thing about the film as well, isn't it? That it, like, you remember them as a comedy, but what you actually remember is all the amazing, like, one-liners from Addams Family Values.
Yeah.
What you're actually watching with the Addams Family is just it's more people just doing weird things.
Yeah,
in front of people who are surprised, and it's a bit like it wears thin quite quickly.
Yeah, and yeah, it's just kind of it's almost all set up. It's all, you know, it's like this is what's going. This is what the house is. This is what the family setup is. This is the background of Festa. This is the complicated process by which you find the massive vaults. You know, this is the Chekhov's gun of the route to the vault that's going to become important later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, yeah, it's otherwise really sort of lacking in kind of excitement. And yeah, it's sort of, there, you know, there are jokes and lines here and there, but I think a lot of, as you say, a lot of what's memorable, I mean, for starters, a lot of them are actually, there are much better one-liners in the second film. It's actually different writers on the two films. The first one is written by Caroline Thompson and Larry Wilson, and the second one is written by Paul Rudnick, not Paul Rudd. Although, you know, I could well believe that he was writing movies in 1993 because he's ageless. But yeah, so I think there is a difference there, and there is a difference in approach, even though you've got fundamentally the same cast. It's just the second one gives these great comedians more to work with.
Well, I think the key thing about the second one is that it's a satire. Or that at the very least, it has this big thread of satirizing middle America. And this doesn't really have that. Like, this one is, I mean, it's just, you know, it's got this, like, gothic sheen over an otherwise very generic sort of almost Weekend at Bernie's style plot that is just an excuse to show us weird stuff happening without any real sort of deeper thread to it.
I mean, it's a very nice sheen in the sense of it's a really good looking film.
Yeah. Like, the design of the film is amazing. And like, the cast immediately inhabit their characters in a really super strong way. With one exception, who I think is better in the sequel, but again, we'll talk about that when we have to.
Which one's that? Go on.
Well, okay, Grandmama is the one person who changes. Oh, right.
The one person who changes, and yeah, is much better in the sequel, because it's Carol Kane in the sequel, isn't it?
Yep.
From
Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah, I mean, the first one does at least, as I say, it kind of gives us, it gives us the sort of, you know, our first look at just how utterly perfectly cast Angelica Houston and Raul Julia are as Morticia and Gomez. It's I actually thought going back to it this time, I think Gomez is actually better in the second one, because I think he gets a little more to do because of the Festa plot in the second one.
Yeah, definitely.
And again, I think, a lot of the better lines that he gets are in the second one. I think in the first one, it's just about him. He just kind of has to be there and just kind of have that voice and kind of say things in the way that he does. I think you do, because of that, you do kind of overlook that he's not actually getting many actually great jokes there. The thing that struck me on watching it this time, that I actually did think that that Christopher Lloyd really stands out. And I mean, it's so like, it's possibly the least subtle performance in just about anything ever. But he really does like throw himself into it. And this is in like a run of films from Christopher Lloyd, where he's done at the back end of the 80s, he's done the last two Back to the Future films. And then he's done Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And then he's done this. It's like, for that brief period, and then what's weird is it all kind of drops off a cliff after this and you barely see him for years afterwards. But for a few years, he is the absolute king of these high-concept family comedy movies. And he's doing something completely different in every single one, except for the fact that he's being quite excessive and shouty at various points in them. But, you know, you could look at a picture of him as Festa and a picture of him as Doc Brown and a picture of him as Judge Doom and not realise that it's the same person. In that yeah, period, he's so good at inhabiting these characters and just really kind of throwing himself into them. But where what the first film does, I mean, again, it is something that the second film does better, but the first film is the star maker for Christina Ricci, who, I mean, I don't know how old she is during the making of the first one. Hang on, when was she born? She was born in 1980, so she's 10 when they're making the first one.
She's a young 10.
And the comic timing and delivery of every single line that she has in the film is remarkable. I mean, she doesn't have loads in the first one. You know, the kids just kind of hover around it a little bit. But the first one does have her, "I'm a homicidal maniac, they look just like everybody else."
Yeah.
And you do feel a little bit sorry for the guy playing Pugsley because he's being so overshadowed by her. But
By how much they give her in the sequel. They clearly went like, oh yeah, she's the real deal. Let's beef that role up for the follow-up.
Yeah. And then you've even got kind of dotted around in the sort of various supporting roles. You know, the fact Dan Hedaya playing a lawyer. Dan Hedaya's always going to be good at playing a smarmy lawyer. It's a completely wasted role, but I do like that the judge guy who he keeps splattering with the golf balls is Paul Benedict, who's a mainstay, sadly passed away now, but a mainstay of the Christopher Guest mockumentary films. He usually has quite small roles in them, but also he delivers what is maybe like certainly one of my favourite ever lines in movie history, which is, "I'm just as God made me, sir," in Spinal Tap. So it's always nice to see him pop up in things. But then again, I don't know how much more you have to say about the first film, but I feel like we probably do want to get onto the second one, because again, supporting cast is something where the second one just really ramps it up as well.
I mean, I guess the only thing I want to say about the first film is how much like Raul Julia is powering most of it. I feel like Angelica Houston has this like presence, but Raul Julia has the energy.
Oh yeah, it's completely like
that performance
running off his batteries.
Yeah. Like that performance is so like nuanced and yet broadly comic. It makes me sad that we lost such a performer. And like that's not something I ever can say I ever felt before I rewatched these films, because I was like, well, you know, I don't really know what he was in aside from this and Street Fighter.
Yeah.
But having seen what he's like in this, I'm just thinking, like, he was absolutely wasted in Street Fighter. And I'm sad we didn't get to see more of Raul Julia Gomez.
Yeah, because I mean, he hadn't done a lot, I think, prominently in American film, really. He'd been a kind of character actor, and I think he'd probably been very much typecast as Latino roles in a lot of things. And I think he was better known, I think, for stage stuff as well. Mm-hmm. But it feels like what should have happened would be these films happen, and he is, you know, along with like Christina Ricci, like his star is made by this in terms of bringing him to much wider attention. And, you know, it does feel like there's a parallel universe where he wasn't ill and he spent the 90s just doing loads more great stuff and a variety of stuff. I think what you say about feeling it more now, I think probably partly that is, like, we were kids when these films came out, and I think we had less of a sense of, like, people's ages.
Mm.
So, you know, he was a grown-up, and grown-up actors die sometimes. And I think when we were kids, we wouldn't have realised that he was only 54, and that was ridiculously young. He would have seemed older to us when we were younger. So you do kind of feel it more when you're closer to a lot closer to that age than you were at the time.
Yeah.
But he's not. I mean, I think there probably is a bit less energy from him in the second film, because I think Angelica Houston talked about during the making of the second film, you know, he was already starting to be quite unwell then. You don't get a sense of it the way you do from Street Fighter watching it in Uncanny Valley.
I mean, some of my favourite Gomez moments are in the sequel, actually.
Mm.
But I mean, let's get to the sequel, because that's the interesting one if we're being realistic, right?
Well, it's just a better film. I mean, I actually, because our initial intent was to predominantly cover the first one on this, and I watched the first one in preparation because I hadn't seen it for quite a while. I mean, I found when watching it that I remembered a lot of it, although I remembered a lot of lines of dialogue because of the pinball game, which we are going to. The second one, I haven't actually rewatched like this week, but I really don't feel like I need to, because I've watched the second film a lot over the last few years. It's one of those things that if it shows up on TV, no matter where it's up to in the film, I'll sit and watch it through to the end.
Yeah, so I remember loving the second one when I was a kid, but, you know, and knowing in my head, yeah, that, oh yeah, that's a good film. Like, Wednesday Addams reaction gifs, fair enough. Like,
yeah.
I remembered it being good. I didn't realise quite how brilliant it was going to be, especially compared to the first, because when I was rewatching the first, I was thinking, oh, actually, maybe it's not as good as I remember. Mm. But it is genuinely that the first one is like mostly a collection of sketches, and the second one is like a full-on satirical look at America.
And I think actually the second one, I mean, we kind of talked about it before with the kind of the memeable lines and stuff. The second one, I think, is responsible for people looking back more fondly at the first one.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because you conflate the two as being one entity. I think because they came out quite close together, so they do have different writers, but they came out close together, they've got effectively the same cast, they've got the same director. You do kind of assume that quality-wise they will have been the same.
Like, it's actively criminal that the second movie made, what, like a quarter or something of, not even that,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, so the first film was 191 million off a 30 million budget. The second film was 48.9 million off a 47 million budget.
That is
so
just risible.
Just over a quarter. Why were people not going to see this in November 1993? I mean, 1993, hell of a year for comedy movies, because you've also got Groundhog Day. And, like, I would say that, like, Groundhog Day is the only thing that stops Addams Family Values being my favourite comedy of the 90s. Also, the following year, is it 93 or 94, you've got Dumb and Dumber. Was that 93 as well, or was that... I've got a feeling that was 94, but then The Mask was 94, so...
Good question.
No, Dumb and Dumber was 94 as well. Yeah, came out in December 94. So this, you know, winter comedies in the early 90s. Like, I think those are the big three 90s comedies as far as I'm concerned.
Mrs. Doubtfire was 93 as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, you know, all right, not as good as those two, but still pretty strong. That's all in one year. That's pretty darn good. Yeah. I mean, you know, Groundhog Day is an almost untouchable masterpiece, but in any other time, like, Addams Family Values, as I say, would be pretty much the standout comedy of the decade. That's how much I like it. That's how funny it is.
Weekend at Bernie's 2, also 93, just one.
Oh, well, I changed my mind. And I think what really kind of makes, what helps Addams Family Values is that actually you've got, often with these kind of films, you'll have kind of two plot threads, and particularly because of the fact that they separate Wednesday and Pugsley off to the summer camp stuff, and they're practically in their own film. And there would be a temptation to kind of say the reason why Addams Family Values is so good is just because of that summer camp stuff. And we will talk about that. But before we do, I think it is worth noting that the main plot of Addams Family Values is still so much better than the first film. The plot is fairly basic, but the plot strand in terms of how funny and how good it is better, largely because of Joan Cusack.
Yeah, so Joan Cusack comes along and she's like a Black Widow murderer who's trying to get her hands on the Addams fortune by marrying and then killing off Fester.
Yeah.
which I like how, even though she's like this sort of, you know, Stepford wife-esque figure in appearance, she's actually almost as dark as the Addams is as well. Like, you can, when she turns up, you can sort of believe that she's like a character who's friendly to them, because she just immediately like throws herself into the like psychosis of the family and, you know, the macabre nature of them.
Mm.
She seems almost at home with them.
Yeah, it's the irony that sort of she, you know, just wants to kill them and take the money, and actually she could actually marry into the family, eventually inherit the money, but in the meantime actually be with people who are very like her and actually be, you know, more happy and settled than she has been in life. She might have even finally got a Malibu Barbie. But I've used that gif a lot of her going Malibu Barbie. It's just, I think it is largely her performance and that character that drives it. But also, I think, again, it really kind of brings out the best in Fester, because Fester's just kind of constant puppy dog, even when, like, she's actively trying to murder him. He's just so, like, happy and delighted to be married to her that he doesn't actually care that she's just repeatedly trying to kill him. The great sequence kind of after they've got married, where you've got the radio in the bath and the bomb and everything, and it's just... I think probably sort of a joke that maybe doesn't work as well is the stuff with Pubert sort of becoming a sort of blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy through the stress of what's going on is kind of a bit of a cheap gag that sort of, you know, I think they sort of run into the ground maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
Although
he does get a really good action sequence towards the end.
Yeah, the Rube Goldberg machine sequence. But I think the thing is, while you've got that going on, even if there are maybe times when that kind of main plot flags, you're always looking forward to it going back over to the summer camp. So Wednesday and Pugsley get sent to summer camp basically by Debbie, Joan Cusack's character, to get them out of the way because they suspect that something's going on. Basically, I think, is it even before they leave that... Oh, no, it's not before they leave that they find out that she's a serial killer, because it's from Joel's trading cards, isn't it, that they actually find out who she is.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
they have their suspicions, and it's enough for her to persuade the Adamses to send them off to summer camp. So they get to go to a classic American style summer camp and basically run headlong into horrible white Americana.
Those summer camp, the husband and wife team running the summer camp.
Yeah, personified by Peter McNichol and Christine Baranski, who, like, especially Christine Baranski, like, I love in anything that she's in. And Peter McNichol, I mean, people who are fans of Ally McBeal will think of him fondly, but I mainly think of him fondly because of Ghostbusters 2.
Father of the Bride for me.
Okay. But yeah, these are two, like, great, you know, they're never lead comedy people. They're just great comedy supporting character actors who pop up and play these ridiculous, cheery, fixed grid. They're basically Ned Flanders running this summer camp. Although I like the sort of, as it goes on, and again, this is something that particularly Peter McNichol is really good at playing, is you get to see the neurosis bubbling under the surface, and as he starts to lose control of things, And he just gets kind of more frantic and neurotic while trying to keep that fixed smiley face on it. is great.
I mean, that actually, this whole plot is kind of a Simpsons subplot, isn't it? In itself, like,
yeah,
it's, you can it's absolutely imagine this being a sort of Bart and Lisa story.
I mean, it basically is Camp Crystal.
Yeah, well, quite. So, you know.
But yeah, I know, and that's where you get. I mean, you get a reappearance of future Buffy star Mercedes McNabb, who I don't know if she's technically supposed to be playing the same character as she did in the first film. She's the Girl Scout cookie.
Yeah.
Which again is one of the best lines, the Wednesday line in the first one about are they made from real Girl Scouts? And then she's the horrible rich kid in the second one, who I think is basically murdered at the end. Like, it's, I don't think there's any way around the fact that like she's actually dead at the end of the film, murdered in front of her parents by being set on fire. But yeah, sort of. So the, you know, they kind of they run up against her, and they run up against the tradition of kind of it's not whitewashing, is it? So much as just sort of sanitizing the story of Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
The idea that kind of all the kind of outsidery kids have to play
play the natives. Yeah.
And all of the blonde white kids, the rich kids, play the pilgrims. And obviously among those outcasts as well is the other kind of key addition to the film, which is Joel, who's the kind of nerdy Jewish bookish boy who Wednesday and Pugsley befriend, and who is kind of sort of Wednesday's boyfriend. It's a really kind of cute, awkward sort of playing out of that relationship.
Yeah, and he also definitely dies at the end.
Does he, though?
I mean, the last line is she says, I'd scare him to death. And yeah. Then, like, the film ends with him screaming.
I'm pretty sure. Just get scared nearly to death.
I'm pretty sure she kills him.
Yeah.
In my head, she kills him.
But, you know, that's again, it's sort of, particularly like looking at the first film, like, I don't think you would have expected to actually have this kind of quite awkward and sweet relationship story play out for Wednesday like that.
No, definitely not.
Again, it kind of it plays to the strengths of kind of Christina Ricci being able to take on something that's actually got a bit of, you know, dramatic heft to it. I mean, it's like they wouldn't have given this plot line to Pugsley. You know?
No, I mean, that's sort of a symptom of the entire, you know, difference between the films, is that the characters are actually a lot more well realized and sort of complex in the follow up.
Mm. Well, it's like they've sort of, it's the classic thing of they've been able to sort of learn from them in the first film and learn about the strengths of the actors and play to them a bit more, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as I say, you know, it's kind of got that. Well, one of the things it kind of reminded me of a little bit is when we were talking about Spider-Man Far From Home, that film that we all agreed on But the kind of the MJ stuff in that, in terms of being the, you know, the kind of aloof young teenage girl with flaws, but actually sort of, you know, kind of not wanting, like kind of almost fighting against awkwardly having to reveal that side of themselves in terms of emotionally opening up to somebody.
Yeah.
And then Wednesday's way around it is to murder him at the end. So yeah.
My favourite, just like, this is going to definitely devolve into my favourite bits from Adam's Shiny Values. Yeah. But my favourite bit, probably in the entire film, is when Wednesday is trying to convince them that she wants to be, like, normal. And you get this really long shot of her attempting to smile.
Attempting to smile, yeah.
And when she finally does it, everyone, like, recoils, and, like, the kids are going, like, ah, make her stop! Like, it's just such a fantastic piece of acting, because it's so funny. And yet, like, the instruction of, you know, smile but pretend to be doing it real, like smile but don't make it look fake, but also make it look scary.
Yeah,
like it's such a complicated expression to pull off, and yet she manages this like really weird, like ominous expression of happiness.
I mean, you talked about this practically feeling like a Simpsons plot, and it almost feels like something that you could only do in animation,
yeah.
Rather than actually like someone's actual face. But yeah,
one of the other things that I think, especially in Adam's Family Values, you get more of it, is like the relationship between Gomez and Morticia is so, like, it's so unlike anything you see in movies almost ever. Like, it's really interesting because, like, most movies have this thing where, like, if you have a romantic subplot, it's basically two characters that are sort of spiky towards each other, especially in blockbuster films. They're like, they're sort of spiky towards each other. They go through some horrendous trauma. At the end of it, they kiss and then, you know, they hold hands for the rest of the film, whatever.
Yeah.
In The Addams Family, you have these two characters who are like absolutely besotted with each other to the point of forgetting there are other people in the room frequently. Like,
yeah.
At various points in the film, they're like seconds away from openly fucking, regardless of what's happening around them. Like that bit where they do the toast and he's like lifting a glass and he goes through a bunch of things and he goes, Morticia and Gomez are like trading off each other and they go to passion, to paradise, to pain. And then Morticia looks at him and goes, tonight. And like, that's in a room full of the entire family. Like, they're, it's really refreshing to see a relationship portrayed as like actually being sexual between two parents who actually like each other, and like not even like each other, like in that sort of doomed romantic way, would literally die for one another.
Yeah.
And for it to be, for it to seem healthy and normal.
And well, because it's not, I mean, it's almost, I mean, from a dramatic point of view, I guess it's almost boring because there's like, there's no threat to it whatsoever. Like the films couldn't possibly introduce any plot dynamic that might mean that they would potentially separate, because you wouldn't buy any scenario that would threaten them. But also there is a real sort of, and it might sound like a sort of slightly like hanky thing to talk about, but there's no, it's really equal. It's, you know, there's kind of no, there's certainly no sense of possessiveness about the relationship at all. You know, and I mean, if anything, it's Gomez being completely enthralled to Morticia rather than vice versa. But it's a, you know, for a kind of family dynamic that is quite centered around the patriarch, in the sense of, I think the character of the Addams Family as a family comes from Gomez the most, but that relationship is not patriarchal in the slightest, you know? And it's the kind of thing, again, it's sort of, you know, you talk about not being able to get more of this because we lost Raul Julia, although I think based on the financial success or lack of the second film, we might not have got more anyway. Yeah. But that is something that, yeah, you know, I don't think, even though, as I say, from a drama point of view, there's not much interesting you can do with it, but I don't think it's a relationship that you can ever really get tired of seeing. It's just so nice. And again, that's why, the you know, this great irony of the worst possible thing that can happen to Wednesday is being locked in a shed having to watch schmaltzy like Disney films, and it's like, but actually at home, you know, she's got the kind of the most stable and loving relationship you could possibly see.
Yeah.
But again, that's that, you know, came back to what we've always said about, you know, the great irony of the Addams Family is that as a family, they're on, the only thing that makes them weird as a family is how tight they are and how much they can. That's actually unusual.
They're like everything, you know, they're like The Simpsons. They're everything that sort of middle America purports to want.
Yeah.
Just not in a way that they want it.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah. And that whole conversation around The Simpsons, you know, and the Simpsons and family values, obviously Addams Family Values, it being a deliberately ironic title, tying into that argument against them as well. But yeah, it always winds me up when people say The Simpsons are a dysfunctional family. You know, they're a family that has issues sometimes, but they are also an extremely rock solid family unit who care about each other. And that's been proven time and time again by the show. And can't be counteracted just by, you know, middle American people seeing the odd bit of Bart Simpson in the first season. but that's a separate argument. Hey, we've never talked about The Simpsons in detail.
Yeah, we've never had a reason to.
A podcast.
We'll get to it.
It's not based on a cult.
Tons of Simpsons
comics.
Based
on Life in Hell. Yeah. it kind of is. You know, it's just, Matt Groening just drew human hair on his bunny characters or whatever it is it says. Anyway, back to the live action Simpsons.
I mean, that's a good way of putting the Addams Family, really, because certainly in Addams Family values, that is basically what they are, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're as close as you can get to the live-action Simpsons. If they were goth, you know, if they were goth Simpsons, they would have been the Addams Family.
I mean, particularly when you look at the fact that, again, the, you know, the second one is coming out in 93, so that's peak Simpsons era. You know, Simpsons has just had season 4 in 93, and is kind of, I mean, it's past its peak in terms of popularity and viewing figures, but certainly, you know, The Simpsons has reached its cultural osmosis point by that stage. Mm-hmm. So, whereas in 91, you know, it's still kind of forming itself a bit more.
Yep.
So, but it is, it's just, I mean, again, we could probably sit here, and I think if I had watched it more recently, I think more lines would jump to mind in terms of just going through and thinking.
I mean,
about
I can go through a few for you if you like.
Go on then, yes. Pick out some other bits.
I like
that are great.
When they're in the hospital and the girl's like giving this really long, involved thing about like, mommy kissed daddy, and then an angel asked the stork to bring a baby, and the baby came from heaven with a diamond and left it under the cabbage patch, and the diamond grew into a baby. And like, and then Wednesday's just like, our parents had sex.
I seem to remember Nathan Lane having quite a nice, because again you've got really kind of good people popping up in the supporting cast, and Nathan Lane as the cop, when like Gomez goes to the cops about Debbie and Fester, I remember that being quite a fun bit.
One of the lines that I like about Fester is when Joan Cusack says like, he's such a lazy killer, and without missing a beat, Gomez is like, acquitted.
Acquitted. That is actually that delivery, the speed of that delivery. Yeah. Acquitted.
What's Chippewa? It's an old Indian word. And then Wednesday's like, it means orphan. Like the bleakness of that entire story. Because like in fact, it's really interesting. Like the speech she gives when she burns down the like Indian play.
Yeah.
Like, you look back at the sort of politically correct 90s, and at the time that probably would have seemed like really out of place. But now, like, what, 20, 30 years on,
yeah,
we sort of look at that and go, you just couldn't do that story without including that now.
Mm.
Like, in a way, we sort of, and I mean we as in like the PC brigade, of which I count myself, like, we sort of won that argument. Like, you can't just uncritically do the story of the pilgrims coming to America and like bringing culture to the savages. Like, you have to acknowledge, like, yeah, it wasn't all great. And it seems sort of really, I'm going to say brave, and I don't mean that as a pun, but it seems like a brave thing to put in there, especially when it's aimed at, you know, kids and families.
Mm.
It probably wasn't as easy as it seems. Like, I don't know, because I'm not American. I don't know how the conversation was in the early 90s, but certainly the fact that it's still going on to some extent today makes me think it probably wasn't as widely accepted that you could criticize, you know, the birth of America in that way, at, you know, in 1993 or whatever.
Yeah.
But I had a good time with that entire plot.
I think it's probably for us kind of British kids watching it growing up, that's probably how a lot of us learned about anything.
Absolutely, yeah.
About that story anyway, both the sanitised version and the non-sanitised version. I just would pick out as well just a couple of lines now I've looked a couple up, but a great one from Morticia, which is, I'm just like any modern woman trying to have it all, loving husband, a family. It's just, I wish I had more time to seek out the dark forces and join their hellish crusade. I love the phrase hellish crusade.
Yeah.
And the line from Joel to Wednesday, which feels like it would resonate for a lot of people, but the line about, what if you met the right man who worshipped and adored you, who'd do anything for you, who'd be your devoted slave, then what would you do? I'd pity him.
I'd pity him, yeah. I've said before, like, pretty much everything about Wednesday Addams explains my entire romantic history. Because she was, like, my first proper crush when I was a kid.
When you were a kid, it's important.
Yeah, yeah, obviously, obviously. Come on, like, how old was I? I would have been 11, so, yeah.
So it's allowed.
It was allowed at the time. But, like, she's extremely smart, extremely miserable, and so is everyone I've ever been romantically involved with.
Whereas I think when it comes to the Addams Family films, my heart more than anything else, as I say, belongs to that pinball table. That was a good segue. I wondered how I'd
yeah, a good segue that makes it sound like you had sex with a pinball table. Well done.
How do you know I didn't? No, but do you know what? Right, genuine story relating to someone who I was interested in at secondary school and did ultimately end up going out with for a bit, where we had both separately remarked on the presence of an Addams Family pinball table in a cyber gaming cafe in Southport. Like, on separate occasions, told to us by a friend of ours who worked there, we'd both arrived and gone, oh, wow, you've got Addams Family pinball. So that became a conversation point later on. So there you go. It is actually relevant. But Addams Family Pinball is 100% the greatest pinball table ever made. It's brilliant. And I'm so pleased that they released a digital version of it that I think you might not be able to get anymore for licensing reasons. But it was on, what's it called? Is it Pinball Addict? Or there was anyway, yeah, there was a pinball app that released loads of classic tables. And Addams Family Pinball is fantastic. What was really weird was watching the first film and hearing lines of dialogue that are used on the pinball table, but they re-recorded them for the table. So in some of them, like the delivery, particularly some of the Gomez lines, is actually different from how it is in the film. And it was really weird hearing them back in the context of the film. Things like, keep the ball, I have a whole bucket full. And, thank you, thing, and stuff like that. But it's just as a table to play. I can't really describe kind of what makes it so great, other than it's just one of those where you always kind of, some pinball tables you play and you're just like, I've no idea what I'm supposed to be doing here, I'm just going to randomly hit things. But the Addams Family one, everything is well laid out and it's always clear about what you're supposed to be trying to hit at any given time to do something. So it's really easy to get into and get into a rhythm with and actually just enjoy playing.
It's funny, actually. I played Addams Family pinball possibly for the first time ever this year at a loading bar in Dulson. Because I went in there and they had it. I was like, you know what? I'm not going to leave without playing this mythical pinball table. So this year, I've managed to watch two Addams Family films and play the pinball table. There's a good chance I'll be seeing the third film.
The new one's still out, so you might still get that in. It's going to be a very Addams-y year for you. One thing that I bet you won't watch this year is the third Addams Family film. Did you even know that there is a third Addams
Family film? I did know that there was one. It's called Addams Family Reunion.
Have you ever seen it?
It was straight to video. I've never seen it.
It was straight to video, but it's the kind of thing, because it's kind of straight to video, but it's very much kind of TV movie sort of values, because it is effectively a pilot for a TV show. They wanted to do a new Addams Family TV show.
I didn't know
that. I've actually seen it because it did used to occasionally get shown on ITV. You know, like on like a Saturday afternoon when ITV had nothing else, they just stick on like
as opposed
film.
To like the rest of the week when ITV has nothing else.
Yeah. But no, so I didn't see it all the way through, but I've seen about half an hour, 40 minutes or so of it. And despite the fact that it's got Ed Begley Jr. in it, you know, and again, love Ed Begley Jr. from his appearances in Christopher Guest films. It's really bad.
I was going to say, my guess is that it's risible.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, I can see what they're doing with casting Tim Curry as Gomez. That in itself is not necessarily a terrible choice. But the thing with Tim Curry is you have to get the right Tim Curry on the day. And they didn't get that here. It's got Daryl Hannah as Morticia. It's got a load of people you've never heard of as the rest of the family, except for Carol Streakin, who played Lurch in the first two films, is the only returning cast member. He also plays Lurch.
I mean, I know him best as Mr. Hom from Star Trek, although he was also in Twin Peaks.
Ah.
He's quite a pretty famous actor, certainly a character actor. He's in quite a lot of things, like anything that requires an unusually large man.
Anything He's that calls in. For somebody who is 7 foot tall. Yeah.
He's in Men in Black as well.
Oh, is he? Yeah. Well, Barry Sonnenfeld.
There you go.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just, it's. I mean, the setup of it is that basically they get accidentally invited to a family reunion of a different Adams family with only one D. And it's somebody played by Ed Begley Jr. who's trying to kill his family in order to steal their money. So he thinks that the Adamses are that, I don't know, it's a whole, it wasn't very good. It's a 90s straight to DVD / TV movie. That's kind of all you need to know about it. So that, I think, did pretty much kind of kill the franchise until this new animated movie, which I think the main thing I've seen people say about this film is, why would you put together an Addams Family cast that's Oscar Isaac as Gomez and Charlize Theron as Morticia and then put them in animation instead of just making a live action movie? It is infuriating, isn't it? Like, with them.
As soon as they say Oscar Isaac as Gomez, you go, how perfect is that? And then they go, oh yeah, he's not actually going to be on screen. You're like, why? Why wouldn't you put him on screen?
Because you've sort of, you know, I think ever since Raul Julia passed away, that has become a role where you're like, well, nobody could possibly play that again. And then all you've got to do is draw a pencil moustache on Oscar Isaac and you go,
Yeah.
And then, yeah. And it's also got Chloe Grace Moretz as Wednesday, voice thereof. Finn Wolfhard as Pugsley. Nick Kroll as Festa. See, it's a really good voice cast, but yeah, I would be happy to watch all of these people playing live action versions.
Though, isn't it directed by the guy who did Sausage Party? Am I imagining that?
It is directed by Conrad Vernon and Greg Tiernan, who are indeed the co-directors of Sausage Party.
There you go. So there's a good reason not to watch it.
But also Conrad Vernon, did they both, or is it just Conrad Vernon also directed, co-directed Shrek 2 and Monsters vs. Aliens and Madagascar 3 and TBA Untitled Animated Jetsons film.
Great, so he's going to be fucking up a different 60s property.
Yeah. I mean, the film, from the sound of it, it's fine. Thing is, I don't like the character designs, and I know the character designs
are more authentic to the original Adams drawings. So
it's not the character designs, it's how they've managed to make those character designs look when rendering them in 3D. And I think going down a route of actually like doing them flatter would have suited it better. Like, you look at the Charlie Brown Peanuts movie from a couple of years ago, that managed to take something that is so famously and characteristically flat. Like, you can barely imagine Peanuts being anything other than flat drawings, but somehow they came up with an animation style that was 3D but still felt natural as a kind of evolution of that. But I don't really think that the look of this Addams Family film does that at all.
No.
It's made more money than Addams Family Values, anyway. It's made $84 million so far. So that's something.
Is that adjusted for inflation?
Well, no. Maybe in the sequel we'll get the voice of Joan Cusack. So it's got Catherine O'Hara in it as well. And Martin Short. This is a great voice cast. So that is basically a run through, aside from talking about the TV show and the 70s spin-off movie and the 90s animated series, all of which, I mean, I've got a vague recollection of there being a 90s cartoon, but any movie that came out between like about 1985 and about 1996 had an animated spin-off.
It goes a bit later than that as well. Men in Black cartoons, Godzilla cartoons,
yeah.
The MC Hammer cartoon where he had talking shoes.
I still can't believe they made a cartoon of Little Shop of Horrors.
New Kids on the Block.
Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, that was the most of the Addams Family. Mixed bag, but with a real standout in the shape of A Pinball Table and Addams Family Values, which is one of the best comedies of the 90s. And if you're looking for something funny to watch this Halloween, then that or A Simpsons Treehouse of Horror are going to be about as good as it gets.
Halloween being famously the day for comedies, right?
Yeah. Well, it is if you don't like horror. So
genuinely, I think Adam's Family Values is like a lot of films you think, oh, that was good, and then you look and you're like, oh, it was good for the 90s. Adam's Family Values just absolutely holds up. Like some of the aesthetics are a bit 90s-esque, and I think I'm mainly talking about the score here. Like, when I'm not sure who did the score.
Mark Shaiman and Ralph Saul.
Yeah. Apparently. So it feels very boilerplate 90s in that it's sort of a bit Danny Elfman-esque.
I mean, it's got sort of... it has to be tied to that theme tune, and it does feel like everything is just a kind of variation on that motif, you know?
Yeah. The best version of that theme tune is the tag team version, Adam's Family Wump, which, if you remember the song Wump, There It is basically goes, Wump, the Adam's Family, there it is.
There it is. I'm just going to, because I've landed on this, and I just want to read you a sentence from Tag Team's Wikipedia entry, which reads, in the early 90s, Tag Team broke stereotypes about the hip-hop genre by demonstrating that there is more to hip-hop than inflammatory lyrics. The success of Wump, There It Is represented a milestone in the history of hip-hop because it has been enjoyed by culturally and generationally diverse audiences, and the interactive, participatory nature of the music gives it an appeal that has lasted over the years. Now, that was almost certainly written by one of the members of the band, but amazingly, it's got three citations. That sentence has got three citations on Wikipedia. And you thought they just added the words Adam's Family to the words, There It Is, for the sake of a cheap hit. Revolutionary.
I can only assume that they're saving an entire episode of Hip Hop Evolution to cover it, because it's not been mentioned so far.
Yeah, so that's it. That's our run through Adam's Family. But it's not quite the end of the podcast. We're going to... we're kind of... Our usual format is to play a game of some kind at the end. And I guess you could call this a game. This game is called How Many of Our Listeners Can We Alienate in One Go by doing a little bit of Watchmen chat. So if you're one of the people who doesn't want to hear us do this, and we put this question out on Twitter, because basically some people had come to us and kind of asked us to actually kind of explain rather than angrily rant and argue with Joe about why we feel the way we do about the Watchmen TV show and why we don't think that there's a good reason for it to be happening. I asked if people wanted us to do that because I felt like we had already kind of given our reasons when we were talking about it back in the early days, and I didn't want us to just spend another news segment going round and round in circles over it. Some people said they did want to hear it. Some people said they really, really didn't.
A lot of people said they didn't want to hear it.
Yeah,
which is why we're doing it at the end of an episode.
So we're doing it at the end of an episode. So if you don't want to hear that, either switch off now or spin on a little bit so you can. If you've newly backed us on Patreon, which a few people have this month, spin on so you can hear your name being read out at the end. I feel bad that actually those people are going to get their names read out at the an ending that the fewest ever people are going to listen all the way through to. So we might do those ones again.
I don't know. I've seen the numbers on our Chronicle episode.
Well, yeah, but we didn't have a Patreon back then.
That's true.
So.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So we're going to just, as I say, I don't want us to spend like half an hour kind of going round and round in circles. We haven't got Joe to argue against. And what I kind of want to do is ask James to actually kind of explain the sort of the historical context a bit more. Because I think it's easy as well to go, well, why are you bothered about Watchmen and not about pretty much any other comic book superhero adaptation where the original creators will probably have been treated badly by Marvel or DC at some point? Like, that in itself is not an invalid point, but I want to kind of get into why it's really specific to Watchmen. So
James, if you don't want to hear any Watchmen Jack, goodbye. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next time for when we've decided what our next episode is. But for everybody else, James, what's the deal in the first place? What happened when Watchmen was first published contractually?
Okay, so certainly for me, the thing about the Watchmen TV series is like I don't feel like I can watch it because, in my opinion, and certainly in the opinion of Alan Moore, who wrote it, the characters were essentially stolen, or his co-creation was essentially stolen from him by DC/Warner, who gave him a contract which stated that they would have certain rights over Watchmen while the original graphic novel, or the, you know, the collected edition of the comics remained in print.
Yeah.
This deal was signed in the mid-80s, and at the time, the idea that a single graphic novel would remain in print for 30-plus years was unheard of. I'm not sure how right I am in thinking this, but I have a vague memory that no graphic novel had ever had an official sort of second printing, even.
The only thing I wondered was whether Contract with God, but then I think Contract with God was quite slow to be successful, so I don't know if by 1985 there had been multiple printings.
Yeah, the one that I wonder about is the Dark Phoenix saga, because that is the only one that's sold as many copies as Watchmen, I think, or had as many editions.
I went Will Eisner, you went X-Men.
Fair enough. On brand. But yeah, certainly the idea that a single graphic novel would remain in print perpetually for 35 years was unheard of.
I think whether or not DC thought this at the time, I think certainly the assumption on signing the contract was, this will get printed as its monthly issues. And it's worth bearing in mind as well with Watchmen. Watchmen was not sat down and written and planned from the start to be a book. It was a 12-issue miniseries. It's just that it's so immaculately constructed, and so, you know, things like the cover design and everything feels like such a coherent whole that you can't imagine it being a monthly ongoing series that was, you know, the later issues were being worked on and written and drawn after the first issues had been published. That is how it came out. It was a comic. It was a monthly comic series. So the thought was it would come out as those issues. It would get a collected trade. There might have been a feeling that, you know, you could, wow, you might get a second printing because it was so hyped and it you know, I think everyone knew it was going to be a hit because of the status that Alan Moore had at DC at the time. But again, this is still a time when this is pre-Sandman. This is comics were not in the bookshops. And, you know, the idea of a book getting constantly reprinted just wasn't on the table. So a reasonable assumption, and as I say, whether or not DC ever actually intended that this is the case, a reasonable assumption on which the contract was signed would be individual issues, collected edition, maybe another printing. In a few years' time, it'll have died down. We won't be printing it anymore. It gets handed back to you. Do with it as you will. And that's not what happened, because it's pretty much the most successful comic in the history of the media.
Yeah, although part of the reason for that is that it's in DC's interest to promote it as such and to keep it in print. Like, there's no denying that Watchmen is incredible. I think had it been any other comic, it would have fallen out of print by now. But DC absolutely cannot allow that to happen.
Yeah.
Not least because they've staked huge parts of their corporate sort of strategy on exploiting Watchmen in various ways. Like, so they did the Watchmen prequels, they've done the Watchmen movie, they're doing a Watchmen TV series of sorts.
Yeah, it's, and this is where this question of, you know, did they ever actually intend for the rights to revert? Because there certainly comes a point where all of these things that have happened would be impossible if the rights were ever going to revert back to Alan Moore. DC can't sell the movie rights to something, to a studio, with the caveat that one day those rights might not have been DC's to sell. And you know, if the rights ever did revert to Moore and Gibbons, would we see a situation where they could order DC to pulp every extant copy that remained unsold of Doomsday Clock and Before Watchmen? And genuinely, I don't know what the situation would be over the rights to the movie and to the TV show, because I think it's an unprecedented situation. I mean, it's never going to happen. I think they're from DC's point of view, they're fortunate that it's so popular, and I think pretty much always will be, that they'll never have to stop printing. They're never going to end up with a warehouse full of unsold, you know, millions of unsold copies of Watchmen, because they've had to keep doing print runs and nobody's buying it. For as long as DC are printing comics, people will be buying Watchmen. That's just a given now. But I don't think that anyone involved in that deal at the time ever expected that to be the case. As I say, I don't believe either that DC kind of I don't really believe that they duplicitously said, you know, that they put that deal on the table knowing that they were going to constantly reprint it.
Yeah,
because you had no way of knowing.
You couldn't possibly have guessed when you print that book that it would sell so much so consistently forever. Essentially, like, it's not something you can gamble on.
But at any point since those initial editions, DC could have decided, and okay, you could argue, well, you know, why should a business take a decision that's not financially viable for them? But they could have decided to make a particular print run the last print run in order to allow the rights to revert. And they've never done that, because it's better for them to exploit it and make loads of money off it.
The thing is, equally, right, they could have drafted some more favourable agreement with Moore and Gibbons that said, like, okay, we're going to keep reprinting the book, you can have the rights to the characters back for more original work or something.
Mm.
Like that, again, that's the kind of situation you get in comics sometimes, which is that one publisher owns the right to the story, but the creators own the rights to the characters. Yeah.
And that's, I mean, because I think a thing that's worth noting is this isn't really about money as such, because it's not like they don't get royalties. And Alan Moore will have been entitled to a lot of money from the exploitation of the Watchmen characters, from the sequels, from the movie, and from the TV show. Alan Moore, for his own reasons, has chosen to forgo that money and give it away. But, you know, it's not like he's saying, DC, you owe me hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, it would never have been hundreds of millions of dollars that he'd make from it. But you know what I mean? It's like, he's not saying, you owe me loads of money for this because I want to take it and reprint it at another publisher and make the money. It's the control over it. It's the fact that the control has been taken completely out of his hands, and things can be done with that property and those characters and that setting that he has no right of approval over. Which kind of brings us, if you sort of, you know, if you kind of accept that there is no sort of, you know, from a legal point of view, nothing DC have done is wrong. From a moral point of view, James and I and many other people feel that, you know, they should leave it alone in order to honour the fact that they've effectively wound up with this lucrative property by accident. But there are those who would argue, bring this on to kind of another frequently asked question about this, that Alan Moore himself has done comics that are based on other people's characters without their consent, including Watchmen. If you want to make that argument that it's a derivation of the Charlton Comics characters, I think it's enough of a distinct thing that that's irrelevant, because the superhero genre is founded on variations of the same tropes and archetypes. But that he has also done League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and probably most contentiously Lost Girls. And at times he has, I think, deliberately pushed the boundaries of, you know, allowable fair use of public domain characters and sneaking in characters that are basically, you know, Harry Potter and James Bond and such.
I mean, so one of my arguments here is that even if Alan Moore is using James Bond, he is not set. Like, he unquestionably is, right? Aside from the fact that the character is named in such a way as to be legally distinct from James Bond, that is James Bond, right? And it's intended to be James Bond within the context of the story. What Alan Moore doesn't do is say, here is an official James Bond comic that I have written with the words James Bond on the cover. Like, there's a legitimacy to him skirting the boundaries of what's, like, allowed that doesn't infringe the moral right of the owners of James Bond. And again, I'm aware that's a movie studio at this point or whatever, right? Rather than, you know, Ian Fleming, who is long dead. But, like, I guess my point is that the use of characters who are in the public domain or who have lapsed, or, you know, the original creators have died, is that nothing Alan Moore is doing is purporting to be the official version of that continuation and not infringing any creative rights by the actual owners of the property. In fact, mentioning Lost Girls specifically, one of the things that Alan Moore did was delay publication of Lost Girls in the UK for a year, because Great Ormond Street, who owned the rights to Peter Pan, came to him and said, like, we understand you're using Wendy Darling, who is public domain in the US. Actually, in the UK, we own the rights, and if you do it, we'll have to sue you. And he's like, well, I don't want to upset a children's hospital. Don't want to be responsible for taking money from them in a legal framework. So I'll just not publish the book until the character is out of copyright next year. So in that sense, he absolutely respects the boundaries that have been placed on those characters.
I think the other thing with Watchmen as well is, and what I don't want to spend a load of time getting into, is kind of conversations and debates that we've been having about, like, creatively, the argument to be made about, you know, why should there be a sequel to Watchmen when creatively there's no good reason for it, because it's a self-contained thing. I don't even really want to get into that, because what I kind of wanted to do with this was to talk a little bit more about the facts and kind of what's actually happened. But the other thing that I think is worth touching on, and this is the thing that's actually, I think, it's actually nudged me more towards your position of ignoring it entirely than I was previously. Because what I've always had is a kind of feeling of distaste around it. And I never bought before Watchmen or Doomsday Clock. But, you know, I did go and see the movie in the cinema. And I might have been tempted, whereas you only... I don't think I realised how hardline your stance on the movie was until we did it for the podcast. And you were like, I literally would not have watched it if we weren't doing it for the podcast. And I was like, oh, shit, we made you watch it when you weren't going to.
Yeah. I only watched it for the podcast. Battle
Angel when I wasn't going to.
I only watched it for the podcast because I could do it without giving money to anyone involved. Because I borrowed a copy of the DVD.
But, you know, I might... Curiosity might have got the better of me with the show, particularly given the positivity of a lot of the reviews. But the thing that's really done it for me is, you know, in all of this, if you are choosing to go ahead and make the thing anyway because you believe certainly that there is a legal right to, and also that you don't feel strongly enough about the moral argument against it not to do it, I feel like the very least you can do is when you have got somebody who has publicly and often discussed the personal hurt that he feels as a result of what's gone on with that work. Now, again, if you're someone who doesn't care about that, then fine, ignore it, whatever, that's your choice. But if you're someone who purports to be such a big fan of this man and his work, and he has said, I don't like that these things happen anymore. You know, he used to have the attitude of adaptations don't hurt the original work because the original work is there. And then a load of stuff happened. And again, sort of without going kind of too much into it, but to talk from a factual point of view, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen got him dragged into a court case because somebody spuriously sued 20th Century Fox, saying that it was a rip-off of a script of theirs called Cast of Characters, which the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comics predated. But Fox, instead of fighting the case, settled it. And by implication, that effectively, from Alan Moore's point of view, conferred on him an implication of guilt, because part of their premise was that he had been hired by Fox to write a comic that they could turn into a film. So he was implicated. And by them settling, you know, while they didn't admit guilt, you know, settling in a court case kind of naturally leads people to go, oh, well, maybe there was something to it. So there was that. And then there was the V for Vendetta movie where... he'd said, look, because of what happened with LXG and various other things, you know, I don't want to be involved in these. I don't want my name to be on it. Just go ahead and do it. I can't stop you. Go ahead and do it. Don't involve me. And then I think it was it Don Silver in a press conference said that Alan Moore had given the project his blessing and was on board with it. And so just basically lied about him having approved it. So I think if, you know, it's very clear that if you are going to do this, he doesn't want his name on it. He doesn't want the royalties from it. He doesn't want to be associated with it in any way. And Damon Lindelof, who purports to be a big fan of Alan Moore, has invoked him in the interviews. He's talked about him in the interviews. He's talked
and
about
he keeps
why
doing it as well.
It. And he keeps doing it. So Alan Moore's name is constantly getting referred to in relation to the Watchmen TV series. To the extent that to the average person, it's, oh, here's the TV series of Alan Moore's Watchmen.
Yeah. And like,
well, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. I mean, at least what people tend to do with Watchmen is not forget Dave Gibbons, which is good because it doesn't often happen with comics. Dave Gibbons, by the way, has no issue with any of this. And, you know, he might have his own personal views on whether or not things are any good, but he's happy for these to happen. And he's perfectly entitled to that view. You know, that's I don't have a problem with him disagreeing with Alan Moore because it's his. So he's entitled to disagree with Alan Moore over it. But yeah, you know, just to keep referring to him so that his name is in the conversation, the best thing that you can do is not keep talking about him. I think other people should be talking about Alan Moore more in relation to this, but in a sense of, you know, arguing against it. But it's, yeah, it's the way that Lindelof has made him part of the PR cycle for it. And that's not on.
Yeah, especially because Alan Moore's position is like, just don't talk to me about Watchmen. I don't want to be involved in anything. I will not comment on it. Like, yeah. You will like, struggle
we're
to find...
talking about him, so we're bringing him into the conversation, but yeah.
I mean, I feel at least we're not doing it to promote the thing, right? If anything, we're doing it to try and convince you that there is a moral problem with watching this creation that's based on Purloined characters, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the arguments I would say here is that part of the reason not to do it is because if you treat creators badly, they don't do more creating. Like, that is... it's just simple logic, right?
Mm.
You will never get the second Watchman out of Alan Moore because he has been driven from the company and from the medium. And it seems notable to me that Watchmen only really started to get exploited when DC became a little bit more sort of beholden to its corporate owners. And crucially... couldn't possibly get any more work out of Alan Moore. Because things like Sandman, which are closely associated with Neil Gaiman, they're happy to keep those characters safe from interference, basically because Neil Gaiman is happy to cooperate and occasionally check them a press quote or, you know, in some cases, an entire new Sandman series that they can then sell.
Sandman is fascinating because it's, you know, not only is Sandman completely lock, stock and barrel owned by DC. Like, it is not creator owned. Neil Gaiman does not own any aspect of Sandman.
Yeah.
It is itself a derivation of existing DC stuff. So even if Neil Gaiman did try to make some kind of claim over it, DC could actually argue that it's all derivative and spinning off from their own characters. And yet, purely for the purposes of keeping that positive relationship with Neil Gaiman, who has a massive audience outside of comics and who, with Sandman, I think has, you know, with like at least in terms of like Marvel and DC comics, I think has done more to bring readers from outside of comics into shops to buy their comics than anybody else, purely for the purposes of maintaining that relationship with him and having, you know, him as a promotional mouthpiece for them, they give him a creative consultant credit on anything they do that's a spin-off from Sandman, and they don't do them without him approving. You know, he won't approve all the material, but he'll approve the fact that they're doing it before they go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do that with Alan Moore because they don't need to. There's no
there's no good reason to keep Alan Moore happy them. Because he's never going to work for them.
Yeah. So it is, you know, yeah. All quite mercenary in the end.
Yeah, and like you say,
that's comics,
in the past,
and that's a
The thing, right? This is another of the issues I have, is that there are a lot of things about this in like 40s, 50s, 60s. Like, all of these characters are in some way exploited beyond the initial expectations of the people who created it. Like, when you know, when Joe Simon and Jack Kirby were making Captain America in the 1940s, they were not ever imagining that he would be at the forefront of like the pop culture conversation 70 years later in the biggest movie of all time. That's not to say that they've been treated exactly the same way as Alan Moore has, because at the very least, like, they were doing the work under a specific, like, agreement that was common at the time. When things changed, and admittedly with a lot of renegotiation, like, they're, you know, they were in some way compensated for the extra lengths to which, you know, the exploitation of Captain America as a character had gone. Like, Jack Kirby, for all he contributed to Marvel, was eventually rewarded for that. Mm. Or at least his estate was. I forget whether it happened before or after he died, but certainly they didn't just leave him out in the cold in the way that DC has essentially said to Alan Moore, go and fucking jump off a bridge. Like, there was at least some acknowledgement that, hey, actually, of everything you've done for Marvel, we're going to recognise that in some financial way. And, you know, when they created those characters, it's sort of a scandal that Jack Kirby and Joe Simon didn't own Captain America when they were published by Marvel. But that was always the agreement from the start, right? Is that Atlas Comics at the time said, hey, either make this character for us or sell us a character that we can then publish.
Mm.
Whereas when Watchmen was made, as we said, it was given to DC on the assumption that they would then give it back at some point. And it's like, if you lend someone your football, you know, and they say, yeah, you can have it back when the game is finished, you don't expect that game to continue for 35 years uninterrupted. It's important to point out, right, I have no issue with people who want to watch the Watchmen show.
Yeah, we're not judging you.
Yeah.
I mean, not really. I mean, no, genuinely I'm not, especially because this stuff isn't hugely widely known and also doesn't necessarily matter to a lot of people. And again, I don't say that in a judgmental way. It's just we are quite invested in this situation. And
yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right?
It, you know,
it does matter to me that the people who create these characters are treated fairly, and Alan Moore in this specific circumstance has been treated extremely unfairly. I mean, Dave Gibbons to a point as well, but he is at least happy with the circumstances or willing to have different conversations with DC than Alan Moore is. I do think if you're willing to watch the show, you should at least interrogate these questions and think, why is it so important to watch a TV show based on a superhero property that seems in some way creatively, morally, like, deficient? Like, why not just watch something else?
I mean, you know, and as you said with the other comparison examples, you know, people could make that argument to me with Superman, for example. I mean, again, it was the deal that was signed at the time. They were basically, Siegel and Shuster were actually conned by Bob Kane, of all people. Bob Kane manoeuvred them into an unfavourable deal with DC, basically to get on DC's good side to get a better deal for himself for Batman. But that's because Bob Kane was awful. But, you know, and you know, it is sometimes a difficult thing to reconcile with being interested in and talking about comics and comic book movies so much. And, you know, this stuff does still go on to this day. And as much as Marvel put people's names on the films, you know, Gary Friedrich was fighting them for a while in the courts. You look at people like Bill Mantlo. I mean, actually, to be fair, Bill Mantlo's brother said that actually, you know, they can't talk about details, but he has had support off Marvel. But again, it's like people in situations that you know, they might not necessarily be in if the deals had been good in the first place, you know. Everyone has their different lines, and it's like, I think what annoys me is when people do kind of go slightly into whataboutism. And at the end of the day, this is something that's a very specific set of circumstances that we are very aware of, you know, and also I think it's partly, you know, again, because sort of the importance to us as comics readers and as British comics readers of Alan Moore, you know, actually kind of knowing people who know him as well, I think sort of probably brings it a bit closer. But I don't want to be made to feel like I can't have an opinion on this when I'm happy to talk about Marvel movies and Superman movies and stuff, because, you could take a stance on all of this, that it's all stolen intellectual property at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean,
ignore all of it.
One of the things actually that makes the world of difference for me is that, like, this happened within our lifetimes. Alan Moore is still alive and being actively harmed by this. It's like, what about the Watchmen TV show makes it okay to actively harm the person who created these concepts and came up with them? Like, that's the question that I can't find a satisfactory answer for that allows me to watch the TV show. And if you can, fine. But at least ask yourself the question before you do it.
Hmm. I'll be interested to see if the TV show features a scene set to Rock and Roll Part 2, because that will really set things off. Well, I think, unless you've got anything else you wanted to add to that, I think we've hopefully explained our point of view to an extent that means we hopefully don't have to ever talk about it again.
Yeah, I think we can, if you made it this far, I think we should promise never to mention the Watchmen TV show again.
Yeah. If you have made it this far, then, you know, thank you for seeing through that. If you enjoyed this episode, and or, you know, or some or all of it, and you haven't already, then please consider subscribing. I'm going into the spiel now, James. You can find us on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Player FM, Overcast, Google, or any other podcast app of choice, unless it's not on there. You can find a full searchable index of every episode at cinematicuniverse.com, along with all the subscription feed links and a big archive of features and reviews. If you are a subscriber already and you like the show, please consider leaving us a rating or a review on your podcast platform. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/cinematicuniverse, which helps us to get the podcast edited and produced and convince our families that the show isn't a waste of time. If you back us on there, you get to hear episodes ad-free and sometimes early, as well as bonus material. If none of you haven't, like, dropped off already as a result of this episode, then thanks to Brendan Roberts for being a top backer, and to all of Ed Edmondson, Ashley Day and Richard Perrett for signing up since the last episode. You can buy our merchandise at cinematicu.redbull.com. You can get in touch with us on Facebook, on Twitter at @cine_verse, or with an email to editorial@cinematicuniverse.com. Thanks for listening to all of that, and we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.